أما الله عليا قل أتى وتكلم أما الله عليا قل أتى وتكلم أنا أفتك بعيني وأكثر منهم اسأل الله عليا اسأل عليا
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Topics in Endurance Sports. I'm your host, Tim. Today is Wednesday, May 3rd, 2016. Thanks to Moroccan singer Faoud Zabadi for the music. And you're going to find out why we have music from Morocco coming up here. You can find out more about me at my website at runsmith.net. That's runsmith.net. And there you can find out my email, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and also about my coaching services, my run coaching services. So please check that out. This episode of Topics in Endurance Sports is brought to you by Spoken Bicycles of Middletown, Ohio. Spoken Bicycles is a brand new bicycle shop in downtown Middletown that also features a craft beer tap room. We offer new road, hybrid, and city bikes. We service all bikes and have gear and accessories you cannot find anywhere else in the Midwest. We will also be having group rides and runs that leave from the shop. Visit our website at www.spokenbicycles.com for more information about our store. And I believe the grand opening is actually in 2 days from when I'm recording this. And the first group run will be next Tuesday evening, May 9th, I think, if I have that right, at 6 p.m. And I know about that because I'll be helping to lead some of these runs. Me and a group of other guys are going to help lead the runs. And they're going to be for everyone. So if you're a fast runner, medium runner, or even a walker, walkers, please, everyone come and hang out with us. You can run, you can buy some stuff, and you can have a beer afterwards. How's that? And the group rides, I believe, will be on Thursday evenings. So again, go to SpokenBicycles.com for more information about that. For today's show, we have one and only one topic, and that's the Marathon du Sable. And we're going to talk to Amy Costa, who just ran the Marathon du Sable. And I'm not going to give a huge introduction because we go over a lot of stuff in the interview. But I will mention how I met Amy. Roughly in 1999-ish, we were both living in Iowa City and our kids were going to preschool together. And she was only there for about a year. She moved away. And many years later, I saw her picture in Ultra Running magazine. And I'm like, wow, that's Amy. I remember her. And so we reconnected and discovered both of us are doing ultra running, which we had no idea that was the case. So it's quite a coincidence. We both ended up being ultra runners. And since then, we've been friends, and I've been following her running career, which you will find out is extremely impressive. And on top of that, you're going to fall in love with Amy. She's a very fun person. And the Marathon du Sable itself, we'll be talking more about that, but just a intro to that, it's a stage race in the Sahara Desert in Morocco. And there are 5 stages over 6 days. And it's put on by a Frenchman named Patrick Bauer, who I think originally was like a concert promoter. But I think the history might be that he went and ran in the Sahara Desert and decided to put on this unbelievable race. If you think about the logistics of it, which we'll talk some about. Also, at the beginning, you'll hear Amy and I talk about some videos. I will put a link up to all these videos, and you will want to go watch them because they're only a couple minutes long, and you get some great views of the desert and what she was running in. So, pretty cool. Anyway, without further ado, let's get into the interview with Amy because, again, the interview pretty much tells you everything you need to know. And here we go. All these videos of you, did they pick you to do that, or how did that come about?
Yeah, that was kind of weird little surprise. I just signed up for the race because I have a lot of friends. I had like 5 friends going, and I mean, just I was kind of working with other races on things. And then I was in Ecuador with Jordan and Michaela climbing in January. And I got this email saying, would I be, could they interview me, MDS? And I wrote back, sure. And I thought it was just like something like I would fill out a form and send back, which I think I did. And then they wrote me back and said, could we like feature you and we want to interview you more? And I just said, sure, I'm in Ecuador climbing right now. I'll be back in like 10 days. So when I got back, they kept saying, are you back? And then they said, is February 1st a good time for our crew from France to come film you in Jacksonville? And I was like, oh, yeah. I mean, I was just shocked. I'm like, they're coming out here to film me? So they kind of explained it. The photographer wrote me, and then we set it up, and he came out February, like, 1st and 2nd and spent 3 days with me filming me and interviewing me.
Yeah, that was actually my next question. Did they actually send someone all the way over to you? But I guess they did.
Yeah, so I was one of six athletes. So it was not just me. I was the first one they came to see. And then they went to Australia to do the father-son team. They went to Spain. Fernand lives there from Brazil. They did, I think, the Italian. I think he's Italian, the 81-year-old with his grandson. Then a guy from, I don't know, it was like France, and then a guy from England. So there were six of us, and I really think, I mean, Fernand, she was an elite runner, but the rest of us, I think it was just kind of like a human nature story. He kind of wanted, I mean, I think Fernand had done it before, and actually one of the other kids have done it before. Maybe half of us had done it and half of us not. I think they just wanted something like of interest, people different, and like I'm a mom, you know, living in the United States. So I think they just kind of wanted, and they knew I did a lot of races in the States. So I think that's why they picked me.
Very interesting. Well, the videos are really good. So I'll link to them and everything when I post this, because not only do they show you, but they show the scenery. So it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Before doing this race, and I guess before things like Badwater, do you actually have to do specific heat training, or it's just the fact that you're in Florida enough?
Well, yeah, I'm lucky that I live in Florida for heat. That's for sure. I mean, I don't do anything. I don't have to. Like right now, it's 91 degrees out. We all of a sudden just got the heat since I've been back. So this weekend I started training again. It was like, it was just soaking wet. And Marathon des Sables, it really wasn't that hot here training for that. But for Badwater, I just can't pull. I work outside during the day a lot with my camps and everything in the summer. So I don't, and then I train a couple of times a day. I can't drag myself into a sauna for Badwater because I'm so hot. It's so hot here, the humidity. So in my head, I just say, I know it's a different kind of heat than Badwater, but it's still mental toughness. I mean, when I go out and run like 25, 30 miles on weekends in the middle of the afternoon on Saturdays in July, June, it's dreadful. And it's the same dreadful feeling when you're in Badwater, even though it's a different kind of heat. Once humidity dry, you know.
Now, Badwater, you don't have any sand, but in the Sahara, you do. I know you have beaches, but my little experience with Florida beaches is that some of them are like very hard. You know, it's almost like running on a road. Cars can drive on them, but the Sahara is not like that. So do you have beaches to practice the sandy sand?
Yeah. Well, the good and the bad is we had a hurricane, you know, in September that came in, and we had a lot of damage to our beaches. So I trained January to March in front of I live at Sawgrass on the beach, a little condo, and I ran every single day on really soft sand, and they've been bringing sand in to replenish the beach. So to tell you the truth, I've been running in deep sand. The only thing I didn't have was dunes. You're not allowed to get on our dunes here. We do have some dunes down in the Wanda Preserve that I stared at, but they're wilderness. You wouldn't get on them. You know, I think that would be hard. If I could have practiced on something like that, it would have been great. But it didn't really seem to affect me in the race.
Did you fly out of Jacksonville, and where did you ultimately land?
we have probably one of the worst travel. I kept saying if we ever get to that race, it'll be easier than the travel. So we left Jacksonville with my good friend David Green, who lives here in Jacksonville, who I run and train with and do races with, and another good friend, Carrie Kanuga from Cayman. She came up and flew out with us and then just happened to be, as we're taking off or trying to get into the airport in Jacksonville, tornadoes were around Atlanta, our connect, so they shut the airport down. Long story short, we got on the last flight to Atlanta, but then we were trapped. It was just one nightmare after another. We like ran to the gate and they wouldn't let us on the gate to Charles de Gaulle. So we spent a night in the Atlanta airport, couldn't even find a flight into Europe. Everything was booked. Lisbon, everything going into Morocco. I think we finally, it was so stressful because we really thought maybe we were not going to run this race. We were trapped in Atlanta and they could not get three of us to Morocco. So we finally got a flight to Charles de Gaulle, but then had to get another, stay another night and go to Orly, another airport in Paris. So we took a taxi over to that, spent another night, and literally we're getting the last flights into Morocco. And we had to fly into Marrakesh. No, we missed Marrakesh. We Orizat, the race start. So it was a long story, but all of our plans changed. And our bags went from Atlanta to Amsterdam, back to Atlanta. And as we're taking off France, 2 days later, our bags are landing in Atlanta. We keep getting updates. And we're like, so the good thing is, all three of us carried our race pack with us, but there were a few little items that we had in our bags, but pretty much if I lost that bag, I had all my race stuff. So that was good. They really, the knife, because you're not allowed to carry a knife, but you could go buy a knife. And a lighter, which I had to buy over there, but everything, because I just knew, you know, I knew I had my race gear, everything in that pack in case there would ever be a problem. And there was.
That's crazy. So what day did you land in Morocco?
So it was the day before the race start. We were supposed to be there on a Tuesday and we were leaving, I think, Friday for the desert with the race. But we didn't land till Thursday night, and we had to fly straight to the race start or the town that they were busing us out. So we missed all of our other connections, like Marrakesh and the shuttle from the race that was taking us out. We had to kind of but we made it. And then my bag arrived, Carrie's bag arrived, but our friend David's literally didn't come till 4 o'clock the morning of the race. And he did have stuff in there that he needed. So it all worked out. We all got on the buses. The photography crew, the MDS crew found me. And then they started the interviews from there. So, but it was exhausting getting, we were just clawing to get to the race start.
How long was the bus ride from wherever you were to the start of the race?
I'm trying to remember if it was 5 or 6 hours.
So you mentioned two people you went with. Were there a couple others, friends that you met there?
Yeah. So I have a group of, you know, the great thing about ultra community, you meet friends and you do races with people and then you kind of plan and organize races all the time with each other. So it's really fun. But this race in particular, I went with David Green, who lives here in town, Carrie Kanuga, who lives in Cayman, Tim Roberts, who lives in Hawaii, and Ted Phillips in Boston. Ted's got brothers and connections from Jacksonville, but the other three, we all did Brazil together. We've done a couple races together now. They came out for Daytona, Yellowstone, but the last couple years I've been doing Brazil and they've been coming too. So we all said this is the year we're doing MDS. So I loved it. I'm not sure if I would have, I'll go back. I would love to go back to MDS. I had a phenomenal experience, but it was really fun to have a group of friends because we all, you know, our family in the tent and we all had each other through the whole thing.
The race is about 250 kilometers or about 155 miles. Are there 5 or 6 stages?
There were, let me think, there were five stages and then a charity race.
Oh, that maybe that's why I'm confused, because some places I saw five and other places I saw six.
Yeah, well, we started on a Sunday. We ran Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday was the long day. Thursday was our rest day. And then, wait, let me think how that goes. I'm confused. We ran Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Thursday was, wait, maybe there was. Wait, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Thursday was the long day. Friday? Wait, I'm sorry. Wait, my brain is fried.
See, now you know why I'm confused.
Sunday was 19 miles. Monday was like 20. Tuesday, I'm writing it down. I got to remember. It was like 25. Yeah, then Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, I guess, was the long day. Yeah, Wednesday was the long day, 52 miles. Thursday was the rest day. Friday was the marathon, last stage. And then Saturday was the charity. Your brain goes to, like, you forget, you know, because we went out 2 days earlier. So I left Friday morning from Orzab. And then you get there Friday night, and you're in your first bivouac in the middle of the desert. And you're there Friday night, all day Saturday. Saturday night, you get rid of all your gear, and you start the race Sunday morning. So you really kind of lose track of time, I mean, of days and You know, they call it bivouac time. They literally changed the time. You went into camp and whatever time it was in Morocco, I'm not sure why, but they changed the time and said it's now bivouac time. Oh. And I think we changed it like an hour. So, like, life is altered out there. You're in your own little kind of world.
I guess so. Okay, as best we can, we'll try to go over the days, but if the days merge together in your mind, that's okay. So what do you remember from the first day?
I remember them all pretty good. Sunday was, I was a little nervous to start, but I loved it. I had a blast. I'm used to running. This was my first stage race ever. So I really had no idea how I was going to do my body perform for 6 days. And I knew the mileage wasn't big, but I still wasn't sure how I was going to, you know, recover and sleep and camp and everything. But the first day was only 19 miles. And we really don't even know the route till you get there, because I think they adjust it. They switch days from what they did last year. They might adjust, the whole terrain. So we really didn't know. But it was 19 miles that first day, so I'm all in, you know, I am highly trained and anticipating like the hardest race of my life, which it ended up being. But the first day I went out and, you know, I'm doing all the kilometer and mile conversion, but it was like 4 miles, we had an aid station, 5 miles, we had an aid station. Then it was like, all of a sudden we were done. And I was like, ecstatic. I was like, wow, this is going to be a blast. This is going to be easy. I mean, it was hot sand dunes, but it by far it was the easiest day out there. I mean, course wise terrain. And I felt fine. I mean, I kind of held back a little bit because everyone told me, don't go out hard. Your first day, first 2 days, do not go out hard. You'll blow yourself out. So I took it pretty easy. And felt really good and really excited thinking that this was going to be easy, but then it got harder and harder.
Does anything stick out in days 2 and 3?
Yeah, they were hard as crap. They were so hard. So we had, which is one thing I guess I'm not really anal about when I go to a new course. Sometimes I just want to run it. I know basic information about, I guess weather, but I don't analyze the course terrain. And what I didn't realize, I knew I was going to be doing a lot of sand and a lot of sand dunes, but I didn't realize that we had to go over these jebels. I mean, I saw pictures of like rock ridges, but so we basically a jebel, it to me is like a canyon, and it was a huge rock canyon that took, I don't know, a couple hours to get up maybe. And there was this was day two, a session of just sand dunes, which I ended up thriving in. Once I got off the flat heat, there were these salt basins that were just dreadfully hot. I mean, I was dying in the flats. And then once I hit the sand dunes, I usually would feel better because you do a little run, walk, and your muscles, now you're using different muscles, and I started feeling better. So when I hit the canyon, I mean, I was kind of in shock. I looked up at it. I'm like, holy crap, we got to go up that. But I loved it because I was jumping on hard ground surface. I was jumping from rock to rock, and I've done a lot of mountaineering and climbing. So I loved going up there. And once you got up to the top, you have a ridge line, and I think I was in heaven. I mean, I loved it. And then you got to go down. And everyone will tell you this, going down that huge sand, you go down on the other side, a huge sand dune, and it is phenomenal. I mean, it's like your treat after going up a couple hours. You get to fly down like a little kid in snow. You know, you're just, I was grinning head to toe. So, and then it was kind of hard after you did all that. It was a really hard day, physically, fitness-wise, because you're kind of scrambling and crawling on rock, and I just didn't realize that. But I felt good. I've done a lot of weight training, so I felt good. And then the last section of just getting in was some flats again, and it just was hot. But I remember actually feeling really excited and happy about day two. It was hard, though, and I was a little worried maybe I went too hard because I was doing pretty good as far as placement at that point. I think I was always like around 14th, 15th woman. So I was a little nervous because I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I wasn't really expecting any of that.
What about day three? Anything stick out from that one?
Well, day three, then you had to turn around and go backwards over that.
Oh.
The sand that we got to fly down and have so much fun, and people were trashed in camp. I mean, we're all like, oh my God. And we knew we had to turn around and do that again. So that you had to go up the sand, and climbing up sand is harder than I think climbing the rock because you're taking steps back, you know, and it's just like you're not. I mean, to me, because I've done a lot of mountaineering, it's so similar to mountaineering. You find a step in the sand, go a little sideways with your, you know, step, and just keep moving, you know. It's so much like snow. It's and I've never been in big sand dunes, but it very much. I didn't carry poles. Probably poles would have been nice there, but I still wouldn't have carried them. I mean, only for that section, the big high dune. Then we got up the dune, and if I remember, I get it a little confused. Was that the second? That might have been the day there were like four Jebels, and we thought there were like two. It turned out to be pretty hard. They said it was going to be a lighter day, day three, because the next day was our long day. So I remember people in camp, everyone's analyzing it. It was going to be lighter than the first day, or that the second day, the hard day. But it ended up, I think, being harder. I thought day three was harder. And I held back a little bit because I knew the long day for me could be a good day for me because I liked the distance. So I kind of held back a tiny bit. But I remember hurting really bad coming into camp the third day because it was just these salt flats and it's like they hit the finish line. Every time we came over a dune or a ridge, you thought for sure that had to be the finish, and it went on and on. Everyone felt like that. Like people were swearing by the time they get into the camp because they're just like, oh, my God, that never came. So it was hard. Two and three, I think, were the hardest days for sure for me.
Interesting. When you say you were, you know, trashed and hurting and stuff at the end of a day, do you mean muscularly, like your quads and legs, or do you just mean like a horrible bonk or all your energy's gone?
I mean, I say that, but I actually feel like I didn't have any day like that. Maybe a tiny bit the very last day, the last marathon day, but I actually was really never bonked or never felt bad. I've had situations in the past that I've gone down. I'm notorious for it. So I wanted to finish this race more than anything. So I was pretty conservative. I mean, when I say I was I know I had a lot more in me. It's just like I felt great in most of this entire MDS race, except I do remember coming into camp day three, like totally depleted. And a lot of it is dehydration. I didn't have enough calories, and that's a whole nother thing, you know, we can talk about, but I definitely did not have the calories I should have. So I was barely running by on the field that I had. I still had a great race, but I should have had more. You know, I was lucky that I kind of got away with it, I think.
Yeah. Okay. What about the long day? How'd that go?
Long day was my favorite. Loved it. Just had a blast. I think mentally I got in my head, this is my day. And I was excited because I'm not a fast runner by any means. And so 20 and 25 milers, like marathons, I'm not good. I'm not fast. So the longer, the better for me. 100, usually anything over 100 miles is when I do better. So a race is like this, I really didn't think I was going to do that well. But so the 52 miles in the Sahara to me is similar to 100 miles or 75. It's the terrain is hard and that's your fourth day. So people are pretty beat down. So mentally, because I did kind of conserve a little bit on day three. And I knew where I was with the rankings, and I thought, well, this is my day to go. So I did. I felt great the entire day. I mean, as soon as the sun went down on that long day, I just felt fresh. I mean, I was so excited to be there. The moon was full. The stars were out. I mean, I just happened to have a great race. I was playing it really tight, though, with my calories. I was like a rabbit just nibbling on a bar because I knew I only had one bar, which was stupid, but I got away with it.
Do you know how long that day took you?
14 hours, 30 minutes. And I thought I was on track for sub 14 the way I was running most of the day. But at the very end, my headlamp, well, my last hour, I'd say my headlamp was really dim. I should have changed my batteries out, and I didn't. I was just using it at camp every night, and I thought that it was really bright, but I was kind of kicking myself. Of all the years of doing this, I didn't put in fresh batteries, and I was kind of tripping and stumbling, and I wasn't really around anybody. We were pretty spread out, you know, at that point, and so it was hard to see. I was in this kind of duny flat area and I was kind of tripping and falling. So I had to slow down just to navigate, even though I felt good.
What was the terrain like on the long day?
Beautiful. I mean, like looking out over the Sahara, I remember I was just as happy as a clam. It was hot. There was just all kinds of different sections. I mean, we were going up and down. I can't remember if that was I can't even remember what day it was, but there was a day, I don't know if it was day three or on the long run, we had a rock kind of, another canyon, Jebel they call it, but we had to use a rope because it was pretty intense third class climbing up. So I can't remember if that was on the long day or the third. But I do remember the long day just had everything. High dunes, flats, kind of a little dirt road section. I remember one time we went through like a little green oasis of palm trees. And then another time went through another river flat. But the neat thing when I was, an exciting thing for me was that was the first day they had the elite start after us. And so I think I don't know if it was top 10 or I don't know who it all was exactly, but I got to see, because obviously I didn't see the top runners because it's a point to point and, you know, I'm behind them. So I got to see the Moroccans and the English guy go by that we've been hearing about, you know, all week winning every stage. And I got to see the top four women pass me. Really neat me, Elizabeth Barnes, you know, who won it. When she went by me, it really made my day. I was blaring my music as always, but I think I had it low or one ear thing out, and she encouraged me. She said, we had our names on our bib so people could say your name. And she went by and said, good job, Amy. You're doing great. Keep up the good work. And I just thought that was really cool. As she went flying by me and like just blew up the dune, but it just kind of inspired me. And then the French woman went past really close behind her. So I was watching them race. And that was, I probably had 15 miles left. And then Fernand, who I knew because she's one of the other featured runners, she went by. So I got to see these amazing elite athletes. And then my good friend Emile from France, she was fourth. She went by kind of in the dark. And I thought, wow, this is exciting. I'm kind of coming in, you know, behind them. I mean, they were 2 or 3 hours start difference, obviously. But it was really exciting for me to kind of be getting to see those elite athletes.
And then, okay, if you took 14, do you know how long, like, the slowest person took? Because I think I've heard that. Now it dawns on me, I think that's why they have the rest day, because some people are coming in practically the next day, right?
I think they had till, was it 4 o'clock the next day? So over 4 hours, 27 hours, something like that. Because I knew people would do 21 next. I can't remember if it was 4 o'clock the next day or 6 o'clock the next day. Because I do remember us all walking over. There would be a couple times in camp they would announce. And I remember that long day. I came in at about 10:45 or 11 at night. And I was lucky, you know. And I just crashed and slept. And my different tent mates were coming through the night. But you were worried. You just always heard people kind of coming all through the night, throwing up or people needing medical, a lot of people needing medical. But I remember the last person came, they made an announcement in camp, and everybody, all the runners in camp, and you're talking almost 2,000 runners, 800 workers, 500 Berbers who are working it. It's a city out there that happens every night. And everybody went to the finish line to cheer in the finisher. So we would do that a lot of nights, which is neat. You know, it's very emotional for everyone, that runner and everybody watching, you know, like the last one coming in. But God bless them. They got to turn around and get back up in a few hours and do it again.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So the last day, which when you listen to the Talk Ultra podcast, Ian Corliss makes the last day sound like, oh, it's this nice little easy finish. But if it's a marathon, that still sounds like a hard day.
Yeah. That was my hardest day. So if you're not talking about the charity race was a blast. I enjoyed that. That didn't count, but that was just a fun little walk with all of us. But the marathon day to me was the hardest. I definitely kind of bonked a little because I think I gave so much in the long day. And then even though I had that rest day, I was hurting. I mean, I was like kind of like after I run 100, my legs were twitching every time I fell asleep, and I wasn't taking care of myself like I should have. All the other days, I came in and pounded protein, and I was pounding water because I knew in like 8 hours I was running again. And I know I did not take very good, and I ate all this extra food the night before the long run. So I didn't want to carry. I ate whatever I had, so I was light on my long run. So on my rest day, I hardly had any food, and I was weak, and I was really kind of bad about drinking. I had like 5 bottles sitting there on my rest day, and of course, they're hot, and I just was having a really hard time drinking. And it was the first time I went to medical to get my feet taped, and I just didn't drink like I should have. So when I did that last marathon, I felt horrible. That was the only day I felt really bad. I just didn't have it to go. I kept thinking, okay, here's the hour and a half. It always takes me a long time to warm up, but I never really had it on that 26-mile day. And there's other people I think had bad days earlier in the week, and they just nailed it that last day. They were exuberant. They were flying past me. You know, they're done, it's last stage, but I could barely make it in. I mean, I think I did 6 hours. It wasn't horrendous, but I should have probably done a 5:30, but I just was hurting. But I knew where I was in the ranking as far as women and my age group. And I thought, if I can just hold on and not collapse and just be steady. But it was hard for me. I really had a hard time that last day.
What was your final ranking? I want to say you were like 17th, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I had 17th woman overall.
Out of how many?
Like 250, 260, something like that. It was the most amount of women they've ever had. And then I was 211 overall. And I think there was like 16 something runners. So I was around, after my long stage, I think I was 13th or 14th women and 185. So that marathon day when I blew up, kind of, it really dropped me. But I'll tell you, I was not feeling good. And I was like, let's just finish it. Like, it didn't matter to me if I was over, you know, it would have been nice to be in top 200. But at the time, I'm like, I just got to get it done.
Yeah, well, you can look at it like the marathon dropped you. But the other way to look for you to look at it is your expertise is going along. So you just took advantage of the long day. You know,
yeah.
You can look at it that way. And so you did everything you could. So 17th is, that's pretty darn good, especially for your first stage race. So, okay. You touched on this a little bit, but each evening when you were done, did you have kind of a recover strategy?
Oh yeah, it's all about taking care of yourself. And so we literally would kind of, I mean, it's very primitive, very rugged, very tough. I mean, it's a hard race physically, but it's hard because of camping and the primitive. Everything's so primitive and you're carrying everything on your pack. And of course, my pack was way too heavy, but so you do, you get your water there. You know, it's not no frills. They hand you your hot tea, which is always really good. It's really sweet. That's the one thing they give you after every run stage. You grab your one or two waters and you just slug your way back to your tent. There's no one helping you, holding you. And if you're hurting because you just ran really hard, you're just kind of wobbling back and blistered, trying to find your tent. And it's kind of like your family, and you're looking who made it in. You walk past all the American tents, and we had the Canadians and the Irish behind us, and just looking, because you get to know everyone, who made it in, who's here yet. And then you literally collapse in your tent for a minute. Heat, that black wool blanket is dreadfully hot. It's just radiating heat, and that's your home. So you go crawl in there on rocks. You're on a rug with just big rocks underneath. And I always just would lay there for about a split second. Well, 5 minutes, but I always knew I wanted to get my protein in. So I'd kind of just roll to get my pack off. I mean, I was always hurting pretty bad because you're just so dehydrated and it's so hot out. And then I would always make myself just like a vanilla whey protein, sometimes two. I'd put my feet up on my pack and just lay there with my feet raised, probably for about 45 minutes to an hour, and just chat with and sipping water and with my other teammates who are, you know, coming in. And we're all just kind of commiserating together. And then pretty soon I always knew I needed to eat. Like, I would always try to get something in my body within the first 15, 20 minutes. It's just, you start running out of food, you know, like I gave away way too many bars and peanut butters. Like, I didn't take them with me at the last minute. I put it in my bivouac, and that was a big mistake. I didn't have enough food.
Yeah, I imagine. Just as far as the sights and stuff, is there anything we missed that you saw that was amazing? Or anything cool kind of happened during the race with other people that you can think of?
Well, it's just the whole thing. I remember going, for me, I mean, I would see people I knew occasionally. If I see David and I, who are really good friends here and train here, it would be amazing that he and I would bump into each other almost every day out there. And that was, there was a couple of times we would high five each other, look around. I remember being on top of a sand dune, and I looked behind him and I pointed up to these camels, you know, in the distance. These wild camels, and I just smiled and, you know, gave them a thumbs up. I'm like, we're here. Look where we are, you know. So things like that were cool. I have really good friends from Switzerland, Ricardo and Jens, that I've met through Badwater, through Spartathlon, different races I see them. And she and I were actually back and forth. We kept seeing each other all day too. They're a couple and they would always run together. And she and I were kind of going back and forth for second or third or first place in our age group, but we are probably the dearest friends. It's such a, like a, if she passed me, I'd say go, you know, it's like, I really want her to have a good day or vice versa. She's like, oh, I feel horrible today, Amy, you go. So we had a beautiful relationship, you know, with that competitiveness. And after every night, she usually came and found me in my tent. And we would go over and hug, and she'd say, oh, you did great today. Or, you know, it was like we just kept going back and forth the whole time. So that was beautiful. I think the only the long day for me was, I just thought everything about the long day was great.
You mentioned camels. I was just going to ask if you saw any creatures. You see any snakes or anything?
Only camels, and I saw maybe, I'd say a lot of like little bugs, but beetles, but that's about it. I never saw any snakes. I think somebody said they saw a snake, but that's it. A tarantula, I think I saw one time, but that I didn't see anything out there the whole time. Camels, we saw wild camels, but then you would see the Sherpas with, or the Berbers with camels a lot.
Are you generally running like on an established trail of some sort, or is it just wherever it goes and you're just following flags around?
They had flags, so there's no trail. I mean, there's just flags, but you, because you're in sand, you're following people's footprints. So, you know, but there's no, occasionally I think, but very rare, you might be on it for like 100 yards, maybe a dirt path kind of that's been beaten down, but generally, it's not. You know, they make mark the course, and you're just running through the desert.
Speaking of some of the people you met, you mentioned Elizabeth Barnes. Is she pretty much just a monster? I know she's won it twice.
Yeah, she's beautiful. She's awesome. She's tall, all legs, super friendly. But I to see, you know, I never saw them in camp much because it's huge, you know, and I don't. You just really kind of go to your tent at night. I would walk around kind of chit chat because I like to socialize with people, but it's usually just the people around the tents around us. But she, I only got to see her pass me that day and she seemed super nice. I saw her maybe once or twice in camp from a distance, but yeah, she's amazing. And I watched her and the French woman. I mean, she was right behind her. And that was the long day near the end, and they're still kind of battling it out. So I was just so impressed with that. I mean, they're tough. They were just flying up these dunes like they were, you know, out for a little trot. I was blown away.
Yeah, I think I saw a picture of you with Lisa Smith Botchin, the American who won, I think, in 99. She's pretty much a legend.
Yeah, yeah. She's a good friend of mine, and she was in the tent next door, and she and her husband, Jay, have been doing, I think Jay's done it 13 times. He was out prior to the race. He's the ambassador for the Americans. So they kind of help organize a lot of the Americans, sign up, give us information. Jay's been doing all that for years. This year, Jay didn't do it, and Lisa came back to do it because they have two daughters, Annie and Gabby. So the girls and Jay left right before the race started. And it was just Lisa's turn to run it this year, which was neat for me because I'm good friends with her. So I got to spend a whole week with Lisa, you know, every night we, you know, trade stories and talk, and it was neat to share this experience with her because she's done it so many times and been so successful. And she kept saying to me, Amy, like she'd give me little, she doesn't coach me. We're really good friends, but she would come up to me like the morning of the long day. And she said, this is your day. Go for it. She said, this is how I want it back in 99 was the long day.
Yeah.
And like, just go for it. This is your day. So she gave me a lot of confidence.
That's great. Was there a guy running with like no arms or something? Did you see this guy?
No legs.
No legs?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. No legs from Britain.
Wow.
Yeah, and he was amazing. I don't know all the details of his story, but I do think he did finish last year. And so he came back again, and I think Prince Harry is the one who came to meet him in England and just wish him well. And so I remember at the beginning of the race, there was some announcements, but it literally is like a couple thousand people. So when we would have the announcements at the bivouac before, I mean, I couldn't quite hear the whole story, but when he would come in, his tent must have been, he had to pass our tent. So he would be, whenever he finished, you could hear the just roar of the, you know, the whole tent city kind of cheer for him. And you kind of figured it probably was him or there were a couple others. There was a young boy, too, who I don't know if he had MS. I'm not sure exactly what he had, but they pushed him in a chair the entire race. And I didn't know much about that story. They were on the other side. But anyhow, the fellow from Britain, that happened in the war. And so I did meet a guy who knew him from Britain. I rode the bus back with, who told me he knows him and how he finished this year and, you know, how great it was. And it was kind of like a Wounded Warrior type sponsorship in England. But he would come past us that night. He finished. Every single night we would see him. And he kind of had a smile on his face. But I can't imagine how hard. Going up those canyons, I can't even imagine.
So he had a prosthesis for his...
Yeah,
like a blade type of thing? Or did he have something with shoes on? He had to have shoes on him, I guess.
Yeah, he had shoes. But you can't imagine the rocks. I mean, some of those canyons we went up and just, I mean, it's kind of third class climbing, rock climbing. It was big rock. I mean, I was kind of blown away how intense it was and thinking of there's a lot of people who walk. And I'm like, how in the world are they going to make it up? I mean, it's just, and then you're kind of scrambling to get it on top of the ridge, and then you're on top of that ridge. So, and then you're going down. So it was a pretty rigorous.
The tents, from what I saw, are they like just open-sided tents?
Yeah, it's basically a black wool blanket, thick and heavy and hot, and they use just sticks. Just sticks that they've collected from the desert floor. And the Berbers came and propped them up. Now, they did stake down your four sides, but it's open. So you could kind of adjust. If you pull a stick out, you could adjust it because we would get sandstorms. And sandstorms come through. Well, one time it just completely knocked down. I was laying in the tent. It just kind of came down right on top of us. There's a little tornado swirling and food and everybody's stuff is flying out in the desert. It was pretty intense. I mean, the sand's in your ears, your eyes, your nose.
That's in one of the videos. They got a video of you right after one of those.
Yeah, my hair was looking good.
Yeah. So, okay, this is a little personal, but you were tent mating with the other girl and three guys or whatever.
Yeah.
So is everyone just changing their clothes in front of everyone?
Yeah, I mean... I usually would try to nag the side. Just I'd get in there early and I try to get the corner just to have my little bit of privacy. And I always had Ted on the other side. I camp for a living. That's what I do. I'm an outdoor educator. I've climbed to camp my whole life. I still take kids out every other weekend, you know, on my trips here. So I'm very, very comfortable with all that. But pretty much. I mean, sometimes I'd walk out to the desert and clean and bathe out far away from people. People can kind of see it from a distance. But I would occasionally say, hey, I'm changing. Nobody look, you know, they don't give a rat's ass away. Like, we're very dirty. We're very smelly. You know, people are just kind of changing in their bag, you know, but it becomes, it's not a big deal. I mean, you got to change. So, I mean, I remember the one day I felt pretty good. I washed everyone's clothes. Well, I just took a little bit of water. I was all peppy and happy that day. I think it's day two. And so I was literally just rinsing out my clothes with water. And then I would pin them to our black our tent outside, and I was offering anybody else. And so everybody's giving me their clothes and underwear, and I'm just rinsing them out. And so we had like a laundry on top of the tent, just so I'm holding everybody's underwear and bra. But you become a family for sure. There's nothing real sexy about it, believe me.
Are you sleeping in your running clothes? Because surely you're not going to waste weight bringing pajamas or something.
No, but I was a little foo-foo. I did bring an extra skirt, but I thought the skirt I would run in, but I brought an extra skirt because I thought, okay, half and the skirts aren't weigh that much. One extra bra, one extra skirt. And that was my goal to like the long day, put it on for the long day. And then what ended up happening, I was so disgustingly gross with my running clothes every day, I'd want them off. And so I would either, well, it was interesting. The first couple of days, I'd use a little bit of water and go bathe out in the desert. Everybody did. Stripped down. I mean, it was great. It was really exhilarating to be naked in the desert far away. No one could see me, and you kind of clean up. And then I would put on my new bra, new skirt every night. And I kind of got into a routine. So I slept in that. And then every morning I took it off and put on my dungy running clothes again. Cause I finally decided I kind of like having these at camp. Cause sometimes I get into camp at like 2 in the afternoon or 2:30. And it was just really nice to walk around something kind of clean.
Yeah.
So that was my little thing, but I think I know for sure, like I've learned so much. The elites, they just slept and wore the same clothing. You know, everything is minimum. No stove. I brought a stove. I mean, there's things I would probably not. I didn't have too much, I thought, but there's definitely things I could have gone without. Like a puppy jacket, I could have just snuggled in my bag when I got cold.
Okay, speaking of gear type stuff, what shoes did you wear for this?
I wore my Hoka Vanquishers, not a trail shoe, it's a road shoe, but I've had severe plantar fasciitis since last summer. That took me out of running all fall, and I just was coming back. I started running again in January, training for this in sand, thank God. But it was still kind of bugging me a little bit going in, so I just wore, these are the shoes that least hurt it. They were not the best shoes to wear because I was getting spurs going up in the holes underneath, and I was twisting my foot a little bit, but it's the best thing for my heel, for my plant. A trail shoe would have been better, but this was just the best for my foot.
Yeah. What pack did you wear?
I had a different pack. I didn't know the OMM yellow pack that I saw online that David and Tim and Ted and I all decided that's what we would get. I didn't know any better. And people had suggested it. And it's kind of what you see everybody has. But when I got there, I saw a lot of the fast runners or a lot of people in Europe have Raid Light. And I really wish, like, I want to buy that pack. It's just a sleeker, smaller design. It opens, like, not from the top, but, like, if you laid it down, you could zip it, like, you know, open like that. Like a, I don't know, suitcase almost. And open, get all your stuff. So, and the CB bag would fit underneath. So, I mean, my pack was fine, but I felt kind of old school. It was bulky. I didn't know any better. I trained with it for the last 3 months. So, you know, it felt okay. But when I got there, I kind of wish I had something a little sleeker.
Okay. So the food, I know that, okay, at least I believe you have to bring a certain number of calories. So how did all that work? What food did you bring? And
2000 calories minimum a day. So I basically, and it's really kind of what I do for drop. I do a lot of like drop bags and self-support races, like in Brazil. So it was almost like packing, like I was packing my drop bags. The only difference was I had to have my meals in there, dehydrated food, not just running food. So I basically picked 7 or 8. Well, I ended up giving I gave back a few that I brought, but, seven or eight meals. I think I doubled up on Wednesday night, the night before the long night, which was good because you're pretty much starving the entire time. I mean, that's just a personal choice. If I wanted to carry more, I would have had more food. But I just went to REI. I'm vegetarian, so I don't do meat, which was a good source of protein for, you know, everybody else in the tent. And I just ate couscous, rice, mushroom risotto that I couldn't stand by the end because I had it three times. Rice and curry, I think. So, but it was, everything was so bland. What I finally figured out by Wednesday, like it was hard to eat because it tasted nasty. I started opening up my S-caps and just dumping like four or five. And obviously I needed this, you know, it tasted really good. But I wish I had some type of little spice because everything just tasted like cardboard. But, you know, I knew that.
So any gels or typical race food?
Well, I don't eat gels normally, but I brought gels and I brought a bunch of bars and my Vitargo, my liquid fuel. But right at the end, when my pack weighed in a little over 20 pounds and everybody else's were like 14, 15, I got like kind of freaked out. So I went back to my tent and I unloaded all my gels, all my like race stuff, which was dumb, you know, and I looked at all my, what I could get rid of. And so I put it all in my bivouac and then you kind of say goodbye to that pack that was before the race. So what the mistake I did was I had packs of peanut butter, packs of oil. It was all my stuff for race running. And I kept going, I never eat gels anyhow. And I might not have, but I wish I had more bars. Because anytime I ate a little bit of, I had myself one bar and then I drank my Vitargo the entire time. If I didn't have that Vitargo, I would be dead. I mean, I literally was counting on that for all my calories. So, and it worked. It just, because they're not that long of miles, but a few more bars would have been good.
Yeah. I'm guessing everybody was starving by the end.
Yeah. People lost weight.
Yeah. Okay. How about any annoying issues? Chafing, blisters, sunburn, GI problems, blah, blah. Any of that stuff crop up?
Knock on wood, I did not have any. I mean, I only had a couple blisters on the long day, after the long day, whenever. And the guy was like, these aren't anything, you know, like, why are you even here? And I was like, oh, okay, I just want some tape. But I was really lucky, and I was really faithful about sunscreen. There's even pictures of me. I had my face zinced out and white all the time. I had a little skin cancer treatment done in January. So I was really neurotic. I never not had my cap on. And I coated myself with sunscreen, but I didn't wear sleeves. I couldn't, they were too hot for me. So I just put on 100 or 80 sunscreen. And maybe because I live in Florida, I have a base, but I never got sunburned at all. No chafing. And I'm notorious for GI issues, no GI issues.
Wow, that is really good. You know, sunscreen can be really heavy, though. So I would think you'd need a ton of that stuff.
Yeah, well, I had like a, you probably can't see it. It's like a stick, a little stick. I got it at REI that was just great. It was just this, I forget the name of it. But I use that on my face every day in a Neutrogena little thing. But it lasted the whole time. We were out there. You know, you're covered in so much sand. So you put the sunscreen on, and then you get covered in sand. Sand blowing on you. You could, like, carve your name out on your arm with the sand. So I was always thinking, well, maybe it's – because I would – every night, if I didn't want to use my water, I would take I gave myself one baby wipe a night to clean with, and one in the morning, I would just be taking cakes of sand off. You never really got clean.
There's the marathon day. What was the next day? You said like a little charity thing. What was that?
Yeah. So the last day for UNICEF, the race, I think some of the proceeds of what have we pay to get in or whatever, that's their charity. So they give everybody a yellow shirt, and it's when the stages are over, but there's the charity race is just kind of a way to get out of the desert. And I actually loved it. Now, people have told me in the past, maybe it's theirs was 14 miles or 11 miles. I think ours was only like 4, which was great. You know, I could imagine if it was a 14 miler, you'd be kind of, you know, whining. But because I pushed it every single day, and I didn't socialize. I mean, I'd put my music on. I would, you know, I'd say hi to people if I passed. But I was pretty focused on running every day and getting into camp every day. That for me, I love that charity day because I ran, walked with my tent, all of us together. And I stopped and I took pictures the whole time. And then we all kind of ran through the finish line together. So I loved it. I thought it was incredible, but it wasn't counted. You know, it was just kind of a way for us to finish, which I thought was beautiful. And then we came through and then the buses were there. And so my crew, I really would have gone much slower playing around. I saw camels out there. I was like having a ball, but my tent mates were kind of on me about keep moving because they fill up 3 buses, then they take buses back to town. And you don't want to be one of the last, or waiting for your bus. You know, there's nothing to do. You're in the middle of the desert. You want to get on that bus because that's civilization. Yeah. And then it was like supposed to be an 8-hour bus ride home, but I think it was only like 6. But you're just filthy. I mean, you just can't wait to get in a shower. Yeah. Back to the.
So was there a post-race celebration party, award ceremony, or anything like that?
Yeah, and that was before the charity race. So it was after that long, or after the marathon stage. So the last one that counted. And that was pretty amazing. I'll tell you, I'll never forget that as long as I live. Here you're in the middle of the Sahara. You've been out there, I don't even know, 8, 9 days, something like that. Haven't seen, you know, really. I mean, you see the city pop up every night, but of tents, you know, it's just all MDS people. And you see the helicopters are flying around a lot, helping medics, or they're bringing people in. So you kind of always see that. It's always a little eerie. You're not sure what's going on. But that last night, they flew in a band from France, and you literally had a concert. And it was, I mean, that was just the coolest thing. You're sitting there having a concert in the middle, and they do a really good job. I mean, MDS, I can't even imagine the logistics that go into that. That is just unbelievable. All the 4 wheels and all the trucks that, you know, pick up those tents every single day, and then they go on to the next stage, and then they create this whole city. But we had the concert, and then they did a sideshow of the race, which was, you know, really cool for all of us. It's the pictures of our race, not previous years, but it was, you know, so everybody's reminiscing, and I was emotionally and physically exhausted. I mean, that was it. That was my last, you know, I didn't have to perform anymore. I was just like, did it, you know, the next day was going to be fun walking out with my tent family, and they did the awards there.
Was there food at this point provided by them?
No, nothing. The only thing they did give on the rest day, I think it was at 6:30. I mean, really, you feel very kind of like a POW or something. On the rest day at 6:30, it was rumored and it was true. We all got 1 can of Coke and it was cold. And I mean, it was like rumored all day. Are we going to get a Coke? Did you hear we got a Coke? Are we getting a Coke? And then it was rumored also, and it did come true, that you were offered at the concert and awards either 1 beer or an orange soda. You could pick your choice. But you literally had your little ration. You have a water cart that you have to get punched every single time you go through. And they're very strict. If you leave one of your bottles, because they're marked with your number, out on anywhere, you'll be penalized. So you were really nervous about all that. But so when you got your Coke, you had to get it punched. And then when you got your beer or soda, you could get it, but you got 1, you know, but it was funny, but it's very, I mean, it's so unbelievable. unbelievably primitive, and people really wanted their beer, let me tell you.
Didn't some people just literally possibly run out of food during the last, either the last marathon or maybe the marathon, they were just not thinking and ate every single bit of food?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have any food. I kept saying to the guys in my tent, I kept going, okay, like I'd be neurotic because I was starving and I wanted more food Wednesday, Tuesday and Wednesday, because I felt I need to have my energy for the long day. So I set myself up for the long day, but then I ate half of one of my dinners for the rest day. And I'm like, oh, it's okay, you know? And so then the last day, I remember all I had left was an oatmeal. I think I only had an oatmeal and I had maybe a tiny bit of a Targo, but I'm like, oh, whatever, you know, I'm walking out 4 miles. That didn't matter. But I mean, you had to, I mean, I'm sure people ran out of food, but there were also people who carried way too much and they were trying to get rid of food.
Oh, so they were everyone's best friend at that point.
Yeah. So I don't know. I was pretty, you know, I just worried about playing by the rules, especially because if, you know, I was in contingent to win anything. So I was, you're not allowed to mule for people. You're not allowed to take food from anybody. So I was very nervous about, especially I was a featured runner. So I wasn't going to take food from anybody. I didn't take anything from anyone. And no one really in our tent did. I'm sure people did here or there, but I certainly wasn't fast enough for that. But I just, you know, you should carry what you eat, I think. But as far as people getting rid of food, you know, no one in our tent was really getting rid of food, though. We all ate our food pretty good.
Oh, that's good.
We were starving.
Yeah, I bet. So then when you get back to the hotel or whatever, then it must have been just an unbelievable feast of some sort.
Yeah, part of the whole package is they feed you like a breakfast and a dinner, I think there was breakfast and dinner, part of the hotel package, because you're there for like 2 more days. So, yeah, when we got back, everybody just showered. I shaved my legs. That's what I couldn't wait to do. Put on a dress, and then we went. Actually, we were so kind of exhausted. We just went down to the hotel pool where they were feeding our meals, and it's an open buffet, the hotel. And of course, everything tasted phenomenal. We just ate till they ran out of food because it's buffet.
Wow. Yeah, that would be nice. Okay, between when you left the hotel, getting back to Florida, did you go do any touring, anything, or vacationing?
We went to Marrakesh, so we went back to the city that we never got to go to because our flights were delayed. And we spent, I'm trying to remember, we got there Monday night after the race, and two of my friends' wives came, Caroline Roberts from Hawaii and Monica Green, my friend here from Jacksonville. She came out, and so that was really fun to kind of have the two women join us. It was good to have some more women around. I enjoyed that. And we went shopping. We went through the markets. We went out to dinners. It was a blast. We had a tour guide. He took us through the markets, and I bought Moroccan rugs and all kinds of little gifts for my children. So it was fun. I loved Marrakesh. I thought that was a blast.
That sounds great. In your training, in your video, I saw that you do strength work in the gym, right?
Yeah.
And like, how often do you do that? And did you do any like really specific strength work for this? Because I guess what I'm thinking about is the weight. Like, every Sunday I hike in an 18 pound weight vest, and I can really feel that. That is heavy. So I'm wondering, did you do anything for that, like shoulder shrugs or anything, or just your general upper body lifting?
I did both. I mean, I kind of do the same that I always do. I'm not an intense gym person, but I do about 3 to 4 days a week. Sometimes more, it just depends if I'm on a good roll or not. Luckily, I work at the university, so I either go at the end of the day, or sometimes if I'm up for meetings, because I'm in the recreation department, I pop upstairs. But I do a lot of pull-ups. I do a lot of squats. I do lots of legs. Not too much free weights. I have friends who are trying to push me into that, but I do use the machines more. You know, it's just for me. I mean, the more I strengthen the legs, the better, I have found, because I don't have hills. So I have to keep my legs super strong. And then, but upper body, I did try to work my upper body. Actually, I've probably lost a lot of upper body strength training with my backpack. That's where I lose my weight. And when I was training, I trained with like a 15-pound back, 12 to 15.
Uh-oh, we have lost Amy. Hello?
Ah!
That's right, nothing's lost. We just continue on. So I'm not sure what happened. It just like froze up.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Okay, anyway, so you're talking about the lifting and talking about training with a pack.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the pack is what I train mainly. I was carrying 15 pounds of rice packs from January, February, and then March. I talked with Harvey Lewis, who American runner who ran it last year, and he gave me a lot of good advice about it. And he said, try to start carrying what you're going to carry in the race. So as I was collecting all my food, a sleeping bag, things like that, I started trying to run with my stove, everything in there. So I think that was the best training of all. And I do, as I was saying, I do some upper body pull-ups, push-ups, but I think just running with that pack, I was doing, back-to-back 25-mile runs, occasionally 30-mile with a 25, back-to-back with the pack training. So that was the best I could, and on sand, so.
Wow. In general, maybe not for this race, because I know you, sounds like you had a shortened training period because of your feet, but in general, for maybe something like Badwater or just general training, do you ever do any speed work, or is it just lots of, just as many miles as you can do in a week?
I'm an old lady. I don't do speed anymore. I'm old. I have done it a lot in the past, but I'm 52 now, and I've just kind of learned when I feel good and I'm running alone, or if I had certain friends who tried to push me, I get kind of pissy. But I do lots of high mileage, and sometimes if I go short and I'm feeling good, I'll push myself to run a little faster. But I used to get hurt a lot I used to run on the track a lot and then try to do 100-mile weeks. And for me, now that I started getting injured, I had a stress fracture, the pelvis, and at 43, 44. And so I just kind of backed off the speed work. I'm just, and it's working for me because I run long distance.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure I would be faster doing 100-mile races, but I just, for me, that's why I'm kind of wanting to do the 135s and the 150s, so yeah. I don't have to do it. Work.
Exactly. I had a question. I was looking at your ultra sign up in 2008. You outright, this is being a little bit sexist, but you outright won the Iron Horse 100 mile, which is very cool when a woman does that. So how cool was that when that happened?
It was cool. My girls, I think, were there at the time. And I had a lot of girlfriends in town who all came out. And those were the days my kids were all swimming. And so I think after a swim practice, they brought the kids out and we turned it into like a sleepover party. But I happened to have a good run. So, it just kind of happened like that. That race has grown and I always try to go out and support Chris Rodat's race. It's a good race.
Nice. If you look at your ultra sign up and the stuff you've done, you seem to be attracted to long, hot races. Is that because you're in Florida, or if you lived in Colorado, would you still be doing a lot of these kind of, I shouldn't say flat necessarily, that's wrong, but long, hot races? Is that just, is there a reason you are attracted to these?
Probably just because I live here. I mean, I used to live in Colorado. I've lived other places. We've moved all over. And I actually feel like I'm a good trail runner. Like I love trail, but I've lived here for 15 years now. And people kind of peg me as this road, flat, Florida runner. And I guess I am because I've lived here for so long. But you know, I miss doing the trails. I'm not as good on the trails. You know, it takes me a while to kind of warm up to them. But once I'm on them again, like I go up to North Carolina a lot with my students rock climbing. And sometimes I'll just go up 2 days early just to run trail, you know. And I know I'm not as good as I used to be on them, but I miss it. I mean, I miss running trail. I would love to. I think I would take it over running road any day. But it's just kind of where I live. And now I do like the more, I mean, I guess I'm used to running warm weather. So like when I go to Brazil and everyone's like dying, it's so hot, I don't find it that hot. In Spartathlon, I didn't find it that hot. So I think it does help. Badwater, I always feel hot. I mean, Sahara, I felt hot. But, you know, it's just, I'm used to it for sure now.
Oh, I see. I probably should have prepped you this, asked you this earlier, but if I came down to your area, what are some of the best races, like Northeast Florida, Southeast Georgia, or Florida in general? What are you think are some of the better races in your area?
Well, there's a lot of good ones, but I guess some of the best. I mean, unfortunately, I haven't been running. I go and support them at the races now. Because I've kind of been doing a lot of international races, and so I'm usually training for some. But I would say one of the top, Bob Becker Keys 100, is a classic Florida race, and he is a sweetheart of a runner, a famous kind of American legend here, definitely in Florida. He's done back-to-back Badwaters. I mean, a wonderful race, and it's from Key Largo to Key West. So, I mean, that's just, you know, it's our classic Florida race. Iron Horse, of course, is kind of my backyard and one of my best races. And I think I've run it 5 times or 4 times. I don't know. I love Chris Rodat. So I would always suggest that because it's in February and you can get a fast time. Dave Krumsky has started the Daytona 100, which is, I think he pushed it to December this year. I ran it. It's only 2 years old, but it starts in Jacksonville, my hometown, which is cool. And it runs to Daytona. And that's a really fast race. So if you're looking for like fast road races to get a fast time, we have, I would say those are probably the biggest. One of my favorite, though, where I train a lot is Caleb Wilson puts on Fort Clinch, and that's Amelia Island area, Fernandina, and it's right across the river. And I run there a lot and train because it's the only little rolling hills we have, and it's all trail. And that I love. I think that's usually end of March. But there we have a ton more all over Tampa. Crooms Trails. Those were probably my first races when I moved here from DC 15 years ago. There was really no one in Jacksonville who ran ultras. So I saw it at, the Crooms, the Andy man, down in Tampa area, and they have the Crooms Trail, and he's got a great bunch of races. Those are probably one of my favorite trails all in Florida. So, but Florida, we have a lot of good races. You can do some fast times here on the road.
Yeah. Okay, so next on your schedule, I think you said Badwater, right?
Yeah.
Any other races that you signed up for or going to sign up for, you're pretty sure?
Yeah. I'm an ambassador. I've been really, really fortunate. The Tour de Gents in Courmayeur, Italy, has invited me to be one of, like, their, I guess, what did they call it, a wild card? that they let me in, kind of help be an ambassador to them. It's a very hard race to get into. I think they only take like 7 Americans a year. And then I talked to them early on. And so I'm very excited. I crewed the race last year. It's kind of like MDS, but not really. It's not a stage race. You have 6 days to run it. I'm trying to remember the distance.
I want to say it's like 200 miles or something, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's in the Alps, so it's going to be completely different than MDS. I am going to have a pack, but it's going to be cold. I'm going to have crampons. They will have life stations that if I make it in on time, I think it's going to be one of the hardest races I've ever signed up for in my life. especially because of where I live, you know, in Florida, it's almost impossible to train. And so
that one is trail, right?
Yeah, it's all trail, technical trail. I'll have poles. I'll have crampons because I could be going through snow. I'll have the emergency essentials in the pack. And if you get into a life station early enough, then I can sleep. They have cots laid out. But if I'm barely making it in the deadline, I'll have to just, they provide food and everything. I just got to grab my food and keep going. So the hard thing, I crewed friends last year. They went like 6 days without sleep. I mean, they were pushing the cutoffs. And so, you know, that, and I've tried to do 200 milers before, and it's the sleep deprivation that got me. I mean, I just needed to lay down and sleep for a couple hours, and then you're like fine again. So we'll see. I mean, this is definitely, I'm starting to, I really want to kind of dabble more into the longer stage races, but this will be exciting. This is something that, I don't know, hopefully just my backpacking mountaineering experience will help me with.
Yeah. So you mentioned more stage races. Are there some of these? There's a bunch of other, well, a few other desert stage races. So are you looking at any of those? Or maybe the Costa Rica stage race?
Yeah, Coastal Challenge. I was talking to all my friends about that. There's that one we definitely want to do. Dominican Republic. We met the race director, a woman at Sahara, who she got my contact. And I think that one sounds really interesting. There's one in Patagonia in November, which I would love to do. There are so many races out there I would love to do, but I do have this thing called a job that I, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, got a, you know, I do have a 9-to-5 job. And then every other, like, couple weeks, I take my students on trips, outdoor adventure trips. So I love my job, but, you know, I kind of got to balance that all out. And then I have 3 children. But they're all in college right now, so, or out. So this has kind of been nice for me, time in my life that I get to kind of do this stuff finally.
Right. All right. Well, that is it for my long barrage of questions. Is there anything else you can think of or anybody you want to mention or thank or mention about the race or anything?
Well, as far as my family, they just put up with me. My kids, I really appreciate them. I mean, their whole lives, they've always had me kind of running and training, but I've always tried to put them first. It really wasn't until they were gone to college that I started traveling for the races. So, but they are my number one support. They all messaged me every single night, I think. I would get the emails. We were delivered emails. And, you know, it just meant the world. You know, my 20-year-old son tell me he's so proud of me, my daughters, you know, constantly writing me, they're proud of me. So that, you know, hopefully I'm a good role model, you know, I mean, that means a lot to me is still to be a good mom and do this stuff. And my work, everybody at work, they just totally support what I do. And all my student staff are phenomenal. You know, I drag them out in races all the time. I mean, for training runs with me, and they put up with me too. So, but I have a lot of support and a lot of friends who kind of help encourage my training. So I appreciate that. And then MDS, I want to thank them for selecting me as a featured runner. That was a very nice thing for me because I didn't know what I was doing out there. And with the 2 Arnauds were the photographers. They followed me. I felt like I had like friends out, and you know, they pop out in the middle of the dune and, you know, filming me. And it really was a special time for me because I'm just an average mom. I'm an average runner, just a normal everyday person. And I'm doing these kind of fun things, but you know, I really appreciate that I got that opportunity to do that.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, congratulations, 17th out of hundreds for your first stage race is really good, especially for an American, because I know the Brits and the French kind of excel at that stuff. I guess because they have such a history of so many doing it. So, and I know, and we have we've had 3 American women win it, I think. No American men so far, but so we need to get the men winning a little bit more.
Yeah, those Moroccans are tough. They know what they're doing. But I do. It's going to be interesting to see the future with ultra running. It's stage races. I know I'm falling in love with them. I know they've been around forever, but you're right. It's a European thing. And we have Grand de Grand. We don't have too many here in the States, but I'm hoping. And I do kind of think with the trend of ultra running, the way it's exploded, I think this is kind of will be the next step for sure.
Definitely more Americans are starting to go to Europe now. And we're seeing like at UTMB, all of a sudden, finally, we're getting some men getting up there a little better. The women have always done a little better, but Coastal Challenge, we're seeing more Americans go down to that one.
Well, and for the gents, that's a big reason. I think I never knew anything about it. Yeah, I always heard of UTMB, but Tour de Gents is on the other side of Mont Blanc, and it is phenomenal. It is such a hard race, and hardly any Americans know what it is. So I'm excited to go and represent Tour de Gents. I'm honored to be a part of that race, and I just hope more and more Americans, you know, want to jump in and do races like this, is because it is beautiful.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Amy.
Okay. Well, I appreciate all your support. It's kind of a neat thing that we have this connection from our kids for 4 years together, and we both became ultra runners, and you've been very supportive of my career for years, and I appreciate it.
Okay, there you go. So I hope you enjoyed that. I think that gives a really good overview of the race and also about Amy. You can really tell she's got a lot of passion for running, a lot of passion for life, and is a very fun person. So best of luck to her with everything. And thank you very much, Amy, for all that, because I think it really gave a good overview of the race. So a few things to follow up on this. Amy actually did win her age group, the 50 to 59-year-old age group, which is amazing. I mean, she goes all the way over to Africa, barely making it there with the flights, and knocks out an age group win on her very first stage race, an extremely difficult race. So that is absolutely fantastic. Congratulations on that. A few other things. The overall winner of that race, as I think we mentioned, was Elizabeth Barnes. She's from Sweden, and she won it 2 years ago as well. Second place was Natalie Mauclair of France. Third place was Fernanda Maciel from Brazil. I think I have these right. It was a little hard to look at the website and totally understand it. The men, Moroccans, totally dominate this for the men. So Rashid El Morabidi won the race, his fourth year in a row. His brother, Mohammed, came in second. Third place, if I have this right, was guy from Britain named Tom Evans. I guess he was a total unknown coming into this and ended up getting third place. But this race, I think it was the 32nd year of it, and the Moroccans have won like 28 of them among the men. I mean, they just completely rule. In the women, it's a little more spread out among countries. The three women who have won, I mentioned one, Lisa Smith Bachin, maybe it's Bachin. She won in 1999, Megan Hicks in 2013, and Nikki Kimball in 2014. So that's the information on that. Amy mentioned the Spartathlon that she did. That is another amazing, grueling, difficult race. It's in Greece, 135 miles, I think. And what's really difficult about that, it's all on road, and it's not flat. I mean, there's like mountains and stuff you go up, or at least gigantic hills. But it has extremely difficult cutoffs. You've got to run fast. I mean, you've got to be like sprinting, you know, maybe not literally, but you have to be going really, really, really fast the whole way. So when Amy kind of says, well, she's just average, she's not just average. That is a really difficult race to get through. She also mentioned Harvey Lewis of Cincinnati, how Harvey Lewis gave her a little bit of help. And he is from Cincinnati, which is very near me. That's why I'm kind of bringing him up. He won Badwater. I'm not sure when. Maybe last year, maybe a few years ago. And I know he's going to be in a 24-hour world championship or something coming up in Ireland pretty soon. So he's a great runner from my area. Let's see, a few other random things. She mentioned Vitargo. So Vitargo is another fueling supplement that you can buy. And just a little bit about this for fun, a little bit from their website or from somewhere. Vitargo is a molecule that dwarfs sugars, for example, glucose, fructose, and sucrose, as well as maltodextrin, the carbs found in ordinary energy and recovery drinks. Vitargo's larger size minimizes its osmolality, I'll mention that in a moment, which allows it to move through the stomach over twice as fast as other carbohydrates. This provides a near immediate surge in energy to blood and muscle, superior to other ordinary carbohydrates. So the whole point of Vitargo, or one big point anyway, is that as soon as you take it, it's getting into your bloodstream very quickly. So it's quick energy. Just a little chemistry, by the way, if you want to know the difference between sugars and carbohydrates, really, in a sense, there is none. It's just the size. Sugars are just very, very, very tiny carbohydrates. So sugars are usually made up of one or two sugar units. All right. For example, glucose is just one unit. Fructose is one unit. Sucrose is two units put together. So these will usually cause sugars. And there's a bunch of different types of these units, like galactose and some other ones. Glucose and fructose are kind of our main sources that we tend to use, like in gels and stuff like that. Other carbohydrates will be longer chains of things. So you can make glucose chains or other types of chains of these. And the longer they get, the more we tend to call them carbohydrates. So maltodextrin, which is really common in your gels, might be about 20 sugar units put together, like 20 glucose molecules stuck together. And Vitargo is like 3,000 of them. So as you can see, Vitargo is way, way larger of a molecule. It's a very large molecule compared to sugar or even maltodextrin. So osmolality, that's really just the number of molecules in a solution. That's really all it is. And since Vitargo molecules contain so many sugar units, you don't need many Vitargo molecules. That's why it has a low osmolality. There's not many particles of Vitargo, but each particle contains a whole bunch of sugar units. And supposedly this low osmolality is part of what helps in digestion. Okay, if you have less particles to digest, you digest them faster, even though they are bigger particles. So it's very complex in that sense. And in fact, what's kind of weird about it, if you've ever heard of Generation UCAN, that also claims to be a gigantic molecule, kind of like Vitargo. But get this, UCAN says it's what's so great about it is that it digests slowly. So it's supposed to give you a more steady supply of energy. So it's kind of funny. This gigantic size of Vitargo makes it digest really quickly, and the gigantic size of Generation UCAN makes it digest slowly. Of course, they're not the exact same units being put together, so there's the idea there. So it just goes to show, with all this stuff with nutrition, you got to find what you like, and maybe in different situations you want different things. So when Amy's finishing the day, yeah, she wants to have Vitargo because it gets in right away, and she's completely depleted. Whereas some people like the UCAN because they say, oh, it's just giving me this nice, steady supply all day long. So there's some of the background on that stuff. Also, I mentioned Ian Corliss. He's got a podcast called Talk Ultra. I mentioned this in the very first episode, and he loves this race. He's covered it for like 4 years in a row now. And he has like a gigantic 3-hour episode just on this race every year. So you might want to check out his recent one. It's episode 133. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And he interviewed Elizabeth Barnes. He's interviewed her more than once. I think he also interviewed Tom Evans, the British guy who came in third. And he does talk about the guy who ran without legs. I did recall that when Amy started talking about it. And he talks a lot about that guy as well. So if you want to get more information there. And he's a photographer. So if you go there, you get a lot of pictures of the race, which is why I think he's mainly at the race to be there, like official photographer. We talked about Badwater a lot. So if you don't know Badwater, many of you do. Badwater is a 130-mile race in Death Valley, California in July. Gruelingly, gruelingly hot. That's kind of its claim to fame. And you're running on road, but you're running kind of partway up Mount Whitney, the tallest peak in the continental U.S. So you're running partway up there, not all the way to the top, but getting close to the top of Mount Whitney. So it's a very, very, very difficult race. And Amy has done it, I guess, 4 times already, and is going to be doing her 5th time. And it's a very difficult race to do. So that's what we were talking about there. So you might want to check that out. She also mentioned the Tour de... I'm not sure how to say this well. Tour de Jantes. That's the race that she's doing in September. That is... I was blown away when she said she was going to do that. That is serious, difficult trail running. So much for me kind of intimating that she's, you know, not so much of a trail runner. And I even looked at her ultra sign-up results. She's done lots of trail races. And by the way, if you also look up, you'll see a whole bunch of first places, second places. She's not just an average runner. I understand what she means when she says that. You know, I'm an average person, and I believe it when she says that. She's not technically an elite runner or anything, but she is one heck of a runner. So no doubt about that. And this Tour de Jantes is a extremely difficult race. So a little bit about it. It says during the tour, the runners will cross 34 municipalities, 25 mountain peaks over 2,000 meters, 30 alpine lakes, and 2 natural parks. The minimum altitude is 300 meters, about 1,000 feet, and the highest is 3,300 meters, about 10,000 feet. The total elevation gain is about 79,000 feet, 24,000 meters. So she's going to go up and down about 79,000 feet, folks. And yes, it is about a 200-mile race. To put that in perspective, this race I'm all freaking out about, Western States, I'm going to go up about 18,000 feet and come down about 23,000. She's going to do 79,000. So that is going to be absolutely amazing. Maybe I'll need to get her on after that, because that will be something. In 2016, the winner took 75 hours. And you get 150 hours, which is a little over 6 days, to give you an idea how hard it is. And the best American result ever was Nicodemus Holland, got second in 2014. We mentioned that guy back in the episode about the 100 Ks of Convenience. He's just a kid, so he's an amazing runner as well. But anyway, I'll post a link to that race site as well. That will be something to watch. That's a heck of a race. I think that's it for the day. All right. So I hope you enjoyed it. I think it was really, really fascinating listening to Amy talk about that. And I think we got into all types of aspect of the race. So that was super, super cool. And again, congratulations, Amy, and good luck with Badwater, Tour de Jantes, and everything else you're doing. Keep up the great work. As far as anything else, again, if you have any comments, still I'm waiting for the very first comment to be sent in. So make an MP3 file. If you don't know how, Google it. I'm sure you can make an MP3 file of about 5 minutes or less and tell me anything you want to talk about. Review a race, advertise something, say something about Amy or something about you did or something about what I've said. Anything you want, all right? So go ahead and send it in, and if it's not completely insane, I'll play it on the show. And maybe even if it is insane. Again, you can find information about me at runsmith.net. All my social links and email and my coaching services. And also remember to visit our sponsor, Spoken Bicycles, at SpokenBicycles.com. Their grand opening in a couple of days. And we'll play a little bit more of the Moroccan music by the singer Faoud Zabadi. I'm sure I say that wrong. And again, if you have anything you would like me to play of yours, send it to me. As long as it's in the public domain or original stuff, send it to me and I will play it. So this is Topics in Endurance Sports signing out. Have a great workout.
لكن في حي السيدة وحبيبي ساكن في الكوفيه Thank you.